You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. A special shout-out this week goes to our newest sponsor, the Frog Breeder Merch Store. Show off your love for frogs and conservation by picking up some unique frog merchandise with portions of the proceeds going to Panamanian amphibian conservation. With everything from adults to kids to stickers to t-shirts, the Frog Breeder Merch Store has everything for the frog lover out there. To find out more and to purchase some merch, check out the-frog-breeder-merch.myspreadshop.com and follow the link in the show description. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandra Bates, your host. And this week, I have a truly remarkable guest. I have Zach Porritt. And you may have seen Zach on social media. He actually did something really incredible. He built an entire greenhouse, for lack of a better word. And in that greenhouse, he's got some incredible plants. He's got some incredible animals, fish and whatnot. But he also has frogs. He has some poison frogs in there. And we're going to discuss the construction of the greenhouse and kind of what went into that, but also some observations about what it's like seeing frogs in a larger environment. Are there any differences between life in a massive greenhouse versus a tank? Who knows? So we're going to get into that. I've got a whole long list of questions for Zach, and I'm really happy he got a chance to, or that we got a chance to get together and talk. And Zach did a great interview on Foddy's podcast, Daffy's Roundtable. If you want to go back and check out that interview, it was a great interview as well. A lot of respect for Foddy. It was a great interview. So if you guys want to catch up some more content, find out some more about Zach with the reptile end of it, go check out Foddy's podcast because there's a lot of great content on there as well. So before we get into it, though, of course, just thanks, everybody, for your support. 5-star reviews, simplest way to support the show, goes a long way. And for the patrons, of course, I want to thank everybody for patronage. It helps me support the show. Helps us support some of the longer episodes, which take up some more space on the hosting site. And that goes a long way. So I appreciate you if you are a patron. And if you're interested in supporting the show, you can check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the Patreon page. $5 a month tier. Get you shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And you'll also find links to the merch store and some links to our sponsors as well. Always check out the sponsors. You'll find links for everything down in the show notes. So I'm ready to get into it. Zach, welcome, my man. How are you? What's going on tonight?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here. So thank you for having me on. I'm excited. I made it to Amphibicast. You know? That means I made it, right?
I feel like I got you. I feel like it's the other way around. I mean, I caught wind of you on Instagram. I think it was Sharif, a bunch of tanks, who shared a video of your greenhouse. And I saw that and I started kind of following a little bit more closely. I watched more of your videos. I watched, as much of your stuff as I could. I caught some of the YouTube stuff. And once I saw the frogs, I'm like, I gotta reach out. I gotta talk to Zach. We gotta have a nice conversation. So I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to come and talk to me.
Yeah, no, I'm ecstatic to be here. So
for anybody who hasn't seen Zach's videos, you built a greenhouse on your property. It's a big greenhouse, and I want to kind of focus on that. But first, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, what went into this before you ever had a greenhouse? Before this inception ever came into your head, were you into animals? Were you into fish, reptiles, amphibians, plants? What was your background before you created this vision to build this massive greenhouse?
So pretty much all of it, to be honest with you. So I've always been just obsessed with animals and stuff, you know. I remember being a little kid and playing with bugs and katydids and then catching snakes, and just pretty much anytime I had a chance to like find and catch animals in the wild, I was all about it as a kid. So as I became a teenager, that progressed, and I eventually got into fish keeping first, freshwater fish. And I stuck with that for a few years, and then I got really into keeping reptiles and stuck with that for most of my teenage years. And then everything kind of just mashed together. I've never been very good at being like a specialist of one thing. I've always liked just trying out everything that interests me. So I pretty much went from freshwater fish to reptiles to saltwater fish to amphibians back to reptiles. And then I've just been all over ever since. But I always had an idea that I wanted to create like a giant vivarium that's like basically a bedroom that you could walk into or something. Like basically just a big enough vivarium to be able to walk in, you know, and cohabitate some species in there. And back when I first came up with that idea, that was like pretty taboo, you know, cohabitating anything back in the day was like a big no, no matter what the circumstances was. And I was a fairly new keeper and, you know, I was young. So I just kind of kept that idea to myself in the back of my mind for years and years and years. And then eventually I kind of got the opportunity to build the greenhouse. Or I don't know if I even got the opportunity, just kind of decided to do it one day and just jumped on it and decided instead of building the bedroom vivarium, I was just going to build a whole massive greenhouse and go all out and do it as big as I possibly could. So it's all spiraled out of control from there.
So from the moment you said to yourself, I'm going to build a greenhouse, I'm going to stock it with animals and plants. How did you get the idea into an actual greenhouse? Meaning like, what was the process? I mean, did you draft up diagrams? I don't know if you had to get plans for the town or whatever. How did you decide how you wanted the layout to be and the construction? Maybe kind of walk us through everything that happened before construction even started. What was the process that led up to it?
Okay, so basically I was working out of town. I was doing natural gas pipelining. So I was living out of town for like a year. So at night I was living with like a couple of my roommates that I worked with. And I was just bored. I'm used to being like a super busy person and being really involved in my hobbies. So being away from home kind of sucked for me. I didn't have any hobbies to delve into. So I would stay up all night and just research random things. And I came across, like I said, I'd always had this idea. I wanted to build a massive vivarium or greenhouse or something. And one night I was just staying up late looking at YouTube videos. And I came across this like geothermal greenhouse build thing. And that kind of sent me on like a little rabbit hole for a few days. And it made me realize like, hey, maybe this is possible. Because my thing was always the monthly cost would be way too much to build something like that, you know? So I just never even like really figured out the details. So it was always just like a little pipe dream in the back of my mind, you know? But that geothermal thing really got the ball rolling. Okay, this could really be possible, you know? So I just started researching like crazy. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll actually consider this. And I think I was up till like 2 or 3 in the morning every single night for like 2 or 3 weeks straight. And then finally I was just like, you know what? This is possible. I'm sick of the world telling me what I can't do on everything. I'm just doing it. This is something I've been dreaming of for a long time. So I'm going into it. So I spent probably, I don't even know how long, probably like a month or two, just like, and I'd been kind of researching things over the years. Cause like I said, this has always been a dream of mine. So I've always had little ideas and how I would do it, you know, and I'd been kind of refining that idea for a long time. I just needed to research like the structure and how to actually build the greenhouse and what would be the best way to do it to make it energy efficient and everything. So yeah, I spent a month or two just like obsessively researching that. And then, yeah, I decided it was possible. So I just jumped into it and started doing it one step at a time. But yeah, hopefully that answers the question. I'm kind of all over the place, but
no, you bring up some good points. And the geothermal heating, my knowledge of it is somewhat limited, but from what I understand, the premise is you're basically using, you're burying utilities to use the earth's sort of core temperature, not core, like the middle of the earth, but you're using kind of a stable temperature below ground to maintain heating and cooling and kind of take the pressure off of creating streams. I mean, am I right saying that, or is like, what are some of the other nuances that go along with geothermal heating?
Yeah. So geothermal is kind of like a relative term, you know, because people do use geothermal for like houses and stuff. And this is different than that. I just use geothermal for lack of a better term, but like some people call it a climate battery or an earth battery. But basically, if you search any of those things with the word greenhouse, you'll come up with roughly what I'm talking about. But basically, it's like ADS drain pipe. So it's just 4-inch, 6-inch, or 8-inch like corrugated pipes. We dug down like 8 feet deep, and then we installed a big whole grid of those with basically, so 8 feet deep, put one layer, and then bury that with 2 feet of dirt, compact it, and put another layer. So what that does is that's connected to fans at the top of the greenhouse. So they push the hot air from the very top of the greenhouse down through that grid underground. And what it does is during the day, the greenhouse, the air at the top of the greenhouse is way hotter. Like it'll be like 110, 120 at the very peak of the greenhouse. So it takes that super warm air, pumps it through the ground, which in turn heats up the ground a little bit, but it also cools the air. So during the summer, it's kind of like a little mini AC unit. And then at night, the greenhouse has the opposite effect. The top of the greenhouse is the least insulated, so that's where the coldest air is. So then it takes that cold air and pumps it down through the ground that you've been heating up all day long, which in turn heats the air. So it kind of, it's not like necessarily a perfect heating or cooling system, but it definitely helps significantly with efficiency. And it's cool because it's all automatic and it just runs off the cost of the electricity to run the two little fans at the top that are just super efficient inline duct fans, you know? So basically costs money to get set up, but once it's set up, it improves the efficiency of the greenhouse a ton and costs almost nothing to keep running.
What's the footprint or the dimensions of the greenhouse?
So it's roughly 20 by 30. I think it's like 18 by 34 or something like that.
And how did you decide the best way to size the geothermal? Because, I mean, digging an 8-foot hole and then putting something over it, I mean, that's a pretty substantial commitment. How did you know how to...
Yeah.
I mean, how did you know how to size it so that it would work properly? Like, how do you... Like, what's the mathematics behind that? What thought process gets you from an idea to knowing that you've got it on lock?
So I just researched everything I could about it. And there's only a couple people I found online that did it and like really detailed it. So I kind of just, I don't know, I'm not an engineer or anything by any means. So I kind of just like used their model and then tweaked it to fit my situation, if that makes sense. But like, as far as the, I think what's important is like the spacing of the grid. So basically, it's kind of hard to explain over a call, but there's like, so on each 18 foot side of the greenhouse, there's, I think, a 6-inch piece. And then each of those 6-inch pieces has a bunch of 4-inch pieces of tube running in between them. And the fan blows it in one corner and it blows out the opposite corner. So the idea is that you have at least close to even airflow moving throughout the whole thing. But I think what's most important is the spacing of the tubes. So everything I read online said 2-foot spacing, just because that's what gets the best, I don't know how to explain this, but the best efficiency of heating up the dirt around it. So if you have 2-foot spacing in between each of the ribs, as I'll call them, then you basically, each tube is heating up 1 foot all the way around it. So I just did it based off that. And then the important part, which I don't even remember how I figured this out, but I looked up a bunch of stuff online about it, but is getting the proper airflow through it. That's kind of the hard thing to figure out. So I just did the system is basically the whole footprint of the greenhouse. So the only thing I really needed to figure out was make sure I had the spacing right, and then make sure I used at least big enough size pipe, because I don't want to restrict the flow too much, and then use a big enough fan to push the proper amount of air through it. But like I said, I've had so much going on since then. I don't even remember exactly how I calculated all that, to be honest. I remember I just researched everything I could online and kind of based it off what some other people had done in the past that seemed pretty successful with it.
And what's the, you're in Utah, right? What's the climate like where you are? Like, does it get hot? Does it get cold? Like, how much does a greenhouse have to work for or against the ambient conditions that happen during the normal course of the year?
Yeah, so I'm in northern Utah, so pretty crazy place to build like a tropical greenhouse, you know. Like during the summer, we'll get highs of 105, 110 sometimes, you know. That's what we've been getting the last few years. And then during the winter, we can get all the way down to zero. Sometimes we'll reach negatives, but not very often. But like average winter is, you know, for 3 or 4 months, we're like in the 20s, getting the teens at night sometimes. And then, yeah, summer is, like I said, a good 2-3 months of 90 plus degrees.
And what about the logistics of, because, I mean, you can't just throw up, I mean, in some parts of the country, I guess you can, but like, you can't just throw up a big structure on your property without having to get permits. And I mean, at least where I live, you want to put up a bird bath, you got to get permits. Well, what was that like? Did you have any red tape that you had to navigate?
Yeah, so I ended up going back and forth with the city on it quite a bit, just because they'd never dealt with anything like that. So at first I hit them up and they were just like, oh yeah, it'd just be like an accessory building, like a shed or whatever. It's not a big deal. Just get us your plans and we'll pay for a permit. Not an issue, you know? And then basically they decided it was too big to be that, just because of the square footage alone. So even though the whole thing's built out of plastic, it was too big to be considered an accessory building. So they randomly decided to tell me that they were basically just didn't know what to do. So they're just going to treat it like a house. And I needed like structural engineered prints and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, well, that's obviously not going to work because it's not a structural building. So even if I had the money for that, that would not be possible. So I ended up going back and forth. I basically just bugged them so much that finally the guy like gave me a way to make it work. Cause I was telling them like in an agricultural area, you know, like I could build a big, huge greenhouse and it wouldn't be considered a structural building. So this is the same thing as that. So you guys need to like figure something out for that. But I won't speak on what you need to do for that too much because it's different in every county and city and state. So for anybody out there looking to do it yourself, you just got to look into your local area. But yeah, I just called the city and bugged them so much that they basically gave me a way to do it and I bought a permit and got it done. So, but I thought for a while that it wasn't going to be able to happen because yeah, when they said I needed like architectural and structural engineered prints, I was like, oh, dream's dead right there, you know?
Well, at least you're able to get through that. That can be a big obstacle for people. I mean, especially depending on where you live and how strict codes are. And I mean, codes exist for a reason. Like by and large, it keeps things safe. I mean, codes keep buildings from knocking over and catching fire and whatnot. So it's important, but sometimes things can be really, really strict. Like, I mean, where I live, you're only allowed to have have a 10 by 10 shed on the property and that's it. Anything else gets into like, then your property taxes go up. And then if like you go to sell the house and there's you don't have a CO for it. Like, I don't know. I'm probably boring everybody with this like old man talk, but like those are all important things that factor into stuff like this. And that was what I was curious about was how willing was local government to just kind of let this thing come to fruition without causing a whole bunch of headaches for you. But it seems like they work with you, which is pretty good actually.
Yeah, they did. I pretty much had to call every single day and harass them for quite a while to get them to work with me. But no, they did end up, which they could have just told me to shove it, you know? So that's good. But yeah, it's crazy because like I live in like the suburbs. So like 10 minutes one direction is an unincorporated city. It's not even part of the county. You could go out there, build whatever you want, do whatever you want. There's like, you know, nothing. You just have to follow like state regulations, I guess, but there's no county or city regulations at all. And then 10 minutes the other direction of me is a city that probably would have been significantly more picky and there'd probably be no possible way I could build it. So I guess I got kind of lucky being able to make it work. But yeah, definitely for anybody listening, if you want to do that, that is something you need to look into first before planning everything, because it can be a huge roadblock and it can dictate. But that is one thing too. When I built it, I had to build everything to code, you know? So I had to be like, write them out off the property line. All the utilities had to be to code, which was actually pretty hard to do, like for the electrical and stuff. So there was like a lot of things along the way that like I really had to do a lot of research and learn how to do properly or pay people to come help me do properly, you know?
I was watching your YouTube video where you put in the, you trenched from, looks like you trenched from your house to the greenhouse and you did, it was a good idea. You did a common trench. You put in, I know you put in like a poly water line, which you insulated. And I was like, you know, cause when I worked in the sewer and drain business for like 15 years and we did a lot of water main and sewer main replacement and whatnot. So I'm watching, cause I'm watching this. I'm like, oh, I want to see what this guy's doing. And like, you did it right, which was like, to me, I was like, oh man, I was like, I hope he's not gonna, you got to bury it below the frost line. And this has got to be, and then I was like, oh wow. I was like, and you sleeved the pipe too, which was also awesome. I was like, man, this dude knows what he's doing.
Yeah. I really didn't want to have issues with stuff like that. So, but the crazy thing is all that I like really did just learn online. So I do utilities. Like I said, I did natural gas, but that obviously didn't really help me. with like public utilities knowledge very much, but that's what I'm doing right now is actually public utilities, like water mains, sewer mains, storm drains, stuff like that. So I kind of have a knowledge of like how construction works, you know, and I know that most people that don't tend to think things are easier than they are. So at least that like pushed me to research really how to do stuff right. And I was like looking up codes and stuff while I was doing everything because I wanted everything. I didn't want to have to redo stuff and I didn't want stuff to fail inspections or anything like that. And I don't want a water line blowing in the middle of winter and killing all my animals because of it, you know, because that's one thing I kept in mind the whole time. It's like the goal of this is to have living animals in there. So I cannot afford to have major mistakes. Like it's really not an option. You know, if I was just building a greenhouse to grow tomatoes in, I probably would have half-assed it. But since it has living animals, I like really have to try to think everything through because that'd be pretty devastating if a water line blew out at 2 a.m. in December, you know, it'd be a pretty hard situation to fix quickly.
Yeah. I actually had a customer and she had a pipe burst in the backyard and it burst, right? And it actually froze over the course of the evening, but it had soaked everything with water that turned into ice. It was actually really, really beautiful. But I mean, something like that can be catastrophic, especially with bad weather. I mean, it's amazing the damage that water and electric can do if you have a problem. What about ventilation? How do you maintain airflow or air exchange in the greenhouse?
So I have on the front of the greenhouse above the main door, I have a big 30-inch exhaust fan. So what that does is that's hooked to a thermostat. So when it reaches a certain temperature, it turns on and it blows air out of the greenhouse. And then on the back wall by the pond, I have 2 30-inch vents that are also hooked to the same thermostat. So they have a little motor. They're basically like louvered vents. So the louvers are held closed with a spring all the time. And then when that thermostat hits, those motors go off. It opens those vents up, opens the fan up, and the fan turns on. So that is mounted. The fan's mounted up high, so it blows out the hot air. And then the vents are mounted down low. So it brings air in, and that kind of brings just like an even draft all the way through the greenhouse to do air exchange. But obviously like during wintertime, that doesn't turn on very often. So what I do is some of those louvers on the vents, I have a couple of them just propped up a little bit, and that gives just enough airflow, I'd imagine. And then I have fans circulating air in there constantly. So I have like quite a bit of airflow in there. But so I imagine with all that circulation, it's probably sucking in enough fresh air for everything. Also, there's like screens over everything, by the way, too. So animals can't escape. I guess I should mention that when I'm talking about like the louvers and everything that are propped open. There's like no possible way for any critters to get out. Everything is sealed off really well with very fine screen.
I saw that. Yeah, you've got a lot of small little animals in there, too. And I noticed that like you did an amazing job, like, keeping everything secure. What about light penetration? How well does it stay lit during the course of the day? Do you have to add supplemental lights? How does that work?
So it doesn't look like it in videos, like it, because the plastic is actually, it's like sold as clear plastic, right? But it's pretty foggy. But it is bright in there. Like sometimes when I'm working on stuff, I have to wear sunglasses in there. So it is very, very bright. But the one thing I'm working out right now is I originally thought, I can get into details if you like, but it's kind of a lot. But I originally thought that UVB would pass through just at a smaller percentage. But I have since learned that UVB does not pass through the polyethylene that covers the greenhouse at all. And since buying a solar meter and starting to test UVB, I've also realized that regardless, even if it did pass through, UVB levels in northern Utah during the winter are not sufficient for most of my animals, regardless, compared to the tropics and other animals that come from the equator. So right now I'm working on getting some lights and stuff mounted in there, but that's just for UVB, for animals like the emerald tree skinks and stuff that are in there. But as far as like lights for plants and just like light in general, it gets very bright in there. During the summer, I actually throw 50% shade cloth on to cut the light back a little bit.
Interesting. Give us a rundown of the animal species that you have in there now. And I want to talk about the frogs, but like what's in there that's not amphibian for now?
Okay, so right now I have the tropical fish pond, which houses like a cool freshwater stingray, black diamond stingray, a bunch of peacock bass, some silver arowana, a tigrinus catfish, and that's it. So that's it for the pond. So some cool, like, big tropical fish. And then outside of the pond, I have the frogs, all the different frogs, and then emerald tree skinks right now. And that is currently all I have in there right now. But I have 3 different species of frogs.
Yeah, the pond was really impressive. I mean, that could be a whole other episode in and of itself, but that's I watch your videos of the pond construction, and I mean, the peacock bass, and they're big. I mean, I gotta be honest, like, when I was looking at the video, I was like, man, I would love to just, like, go in there with a spinning rod and, like, throw a topwater on there. But I mean, that's gotta be a whole challenge managing that size of a pond with those fish in there. But I mean, the amphibian aspect of it, that's what I really want to focus on, is you went with Terribilis, right? That was was that the first species of frog you went for, or did you start with something else?
Yep, those were the first ones in. So those were the first living thing going in the greenhouse besides fish. I guess not the first living thing, I had some invertebrates or whatever, but the first animal I added to the greenhouse besides fish.
On Terribilis, any particular reason, or even that, the orange blackfoot morph, like, why that? Why not, like, mint or Tinctorius or another species?
Yeah, so a bunch of reasons. So I love orange blackfoot. I think out of the Terribilis, they're my favorite. I think mints are really cool too, but kind of with the whole thing I'm doing with the greenhouse, I'm trying to find this balance between actually making things look as natural as possible, but also still having really cool, unique things and not trying to make things look perfectly wild type, you know? But which mint Terribilis are awesome, but to people that don't know about frogs, that's like a very unnatural looking thing in there. But so I chose the orange blackfoot, but mostly just they're my favorite, Terribilis. And then the reason I chose Terribilis is because they're just like the perfect frog for that situation. You know, they're super bold, they're active. And I was kind of concerned at first, like, I had my theories on how everything was going to work, you know, but you're always concerned that it's not actually going to work out how you want. So I figured Terribilis are really good eaters. They're really aggressive eaters, so they would be easy to spot feed if I need to. Whereas other dart frogs might be impossible to spot feed, or I might throw them in there and they just disappear and I'll never ever see them again. Where the Terribilis, I was pretty confident that they'd be a good first frog in there because they're active during the day, super good eaters. There's not really a downside to them, you know. Like I put what I have 6 in there right now, and I can find 4 or 5 of them like at any given day. So there's a lot of other dart frogs that, like, if I threw a bunch of Aratus in there, I'd probably never see them, you know, they'd be gone forever.
Yeah, that's a good point. Certain species are pretty shy. And I mean, my Terribilis, they're monsters. They're just like, they don't care about anything. They're just like the most visually present. Like, I guess when you're the most poisonous thing on the planet or one of the most, you just kind of don't care, but they're pretty badass. What age did you put them in? Did you put them in as adults or juveniles? Like, when did you decide they were ready to go into the greenhouse?
They were juveniles. So they were about 6 months old, 6-7 months old when they went in.
How long have they been in the greenhouse for? Like, year, 6 months, or how long would you say?
Probably about 6 months.
So when you initially let them go, did they, because what I'm interested in is the territoriality, because you've got a big space, and anybody who's kept Terribilis, I mean, usually, I mean, not large compared to what you have, but relatively large, 36 by 18 footprint. It's generally what people will go for with a group. So, I mean, mine, not, they're not like territorial per se, but there's like almost like there's not enough room to really eke out individual territories. Like, what have you observed about their behavior in this big environment? Do they stay in one little area? Do they spread out? Does one have an area that it protects? Like, what's that dynamic and how does that play out?
Yeah, so it's actually been interesting. So one thing, I have one that's older than the rest. Okay, so I had that one in there, and then I got the other five from Sharif. And I thought they were similar age, but I wasn't for sure on the age of the first one I had in there. So he told me the ones he was sending me were like 6-7 months. And I was like, okay. And then I got them, and they're significantly smaller than the other one I had. So I was like, oh, man, hopefully this is not a problem. And I put them in there, and the big one hopped right over to all the little ones. And one of the little ones literally jumped on his back. And they just did not care at all. So there has been like zero aggression at all that I've noticed. And I think the reason is because there's so much space that if one's getting bothered, it can just leap. It can just go to a whole new territory. And that's one thing I've really tried to do, is create like little microclimates, you know? So there's as many like cool little territories as possible. That way things have comfortable spaces to go to. And okay, so rewind a little bit. When I first put them in, basically for the first, this seems to be like the trend with everything I put in there so far, but for the first like 5 days or so, everything is super active. Every day when I come up, like go out there, I can see them all. They're all super, super active. And then after 5-6 days or so, boom, they disappear. And I hardly see anything for like a month. And that's when I get just like super nervous. I'm overthinking everything. I'm panicking. But then I see one here or there, you know, but they're super, super shy. And then after a month or so, boom, super, super active again. So my theory is that when I put things in there, first, they're just like figuring out what's going on. They're exploring. They're kind of finding their own territories, possibly finding hiding spots they prefer. And then after 5 or 6 days or so, they find all their hiding spots and they're kind of shy and they disappear for a while. And then after a month or so, once they learn that there's not really any threats in there, they get super active again. So I just call that like the month-long acclimation period, kind of, it seems like. Like, it's that way with the skinks, it's that way with everything. But since then, they kind of all have their own little territories. Like, I know roughly where I can find each one, you know? Like, I know my big yellow one, I call it Frogbert, but he always hangs out in the big, huge Vericia bromeliad that I have. And then there's one that just always hangs out on the rock wall by the pond. There's one that just loves hanging out like back where the pond filtration is, in the stupidest spot too. There's no plants, no nothing. He just loves it back there. And then there's like one that hangs out under this one corner of the boardwalk. And then every few weeks or month or so, their territories kind of change. Cause I'm getting to the point where I can recognize individual frogs. There's like two or three that I can for sure recognize. And I watch them actually like switch territories and change things up. And then sometimes I'll find three of them hanging out together randomly one day, and they'll hang out that way for hours. And then I'll never see those three hanging out again for weeks. So it's kind of weird. They all have their own little territories, but they definitely interact with each other a little bit. But I've seen like no aggressive behavior at all, even between ones with pretty big size differences.
Is there an area that you could measure off? Like, is it, you know, say 3 square feet, 5 square feet, what's the average territory size for any one of the frogs?
So I think it more just has to do with the habitat, you know? So like I said, one really likes the rock wall, because I have the rock wall with a big monstera there. So there's big leaves shading the rock wall, and he always hangs out in this one spot of the rock wall. And then, so like if I had another really good hiding spot, or maybe a huge bromeliad like 2 feet away from that, one would probably take that up as a territory. But since I don't, nobody else is really anywhere close to that. So I would say like everything's like, I don't know, between 2 and 5 feet. But like I said, I think it's more based off what the environment has to offer them, more than them equally spacing themselves, you know?
Have you got any calling yet?
Yes, last week I just started, so I for sure have 2 males calling now. I'm like super excited about that too. I've been just anxiously waiting to hear calling. Cause that's another reason, I guess, I should have mentioned that I chose Terribilis, is I love their call. And I think the greenhouse will be a super awesome place to go out there and hear little Terribilis calling all over. It'll be super cool. Adds to the jungle vibes, you know?
Yeah, that call is something. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how they reproduce. I mean, I'm like 100% sure they're going to reproduce for you. It'd just be interesting to see how it plays out, where they deposit the tadpoles, and it's going to be interesting. You know, it's almost like keeping animals in a tank is great, but it's not the same as keeping them in this massive area, because the behavior is going to be so different. And like what you mentioned earlier about the cohabbing thing, like my issue with keeping multiple animals of whatever it is, whether it's the same species, different, whatever, is just that in the average tank, you know, the average 18 by 18, 36 by whatever, it really isn't a lot of room for animals to escape each other. Like if one animal's getting bullied, you might have to separate them. And it's just, I feel like it's a different dynamic. Whereas what you have, I mean, like you said, one frog can just disappear and then really not have to interact with any of the other frogs at all, because you've got such a massive footprint. So
yeah,
I wonder if, I mean, again, like one of the things I've talked about on the show is I feel like over time we've kind of selected for frogs that just tolerate captivity better. But I wonder if they default back to certain behaviors if they're given a much larger area to exist in.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's I built a greenhouse for many different reasons, right? But one of the main reasons for me personally is so like I said, I don't specialize in anything. I like aquariums, I like frogs, I like reptiles, I like everything, you know? But what I really, really like is I like watching interactions and behaviors, right? So that's why I kind of transitioned from aquariums, and then I got into snakes and stuff, and then I got into amphibians, because I figured out dart frog people were who I like vibed with the most, because they like to set up really naturalistic things to watch animals' behaviors, right? And then obviously my idea expanded from that. But so like with the greenhouse, that's what I'm so curious about. Like my goal is to create as many different types of egg deposition sites as I possibly can, and have different ones at different temperatures, like everything. I want as much little microclimates as I possibly can that I can track. That way I can watch the animals over the years and learn. And I'm really hoping that I can learn things that we can't typically learn in captivity because of enclosure size, you know? But I'm with you. I like cohabitation, but it's one of those things that has to be done right, you know? That's why it's like, yeah, it's like one of those things where I'm like, do I promote it or do I not promote it, you know? It's like, yeah, I think it's a great thing when done right. But yeah, in a 18 by 18 by 24 exoterra, it's not done right, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Even like the whole terrestrial thing, you know? Like people see their pterobolus jump up on the back of their tank and they're like, oh, they're not a terrestrial frog. I'm like, you realize in the wild, terrestrial means like 0 to 6 feet, right? Like arboreal means like 35 meters in a tree. That's not, we don't replicate that in enclosures at all. We can't, you know? So technically every one of our enclosures is a terrestrial enclosure to an extent, you know?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I've like the terrarium world is weird. It's not really so much with the dart frog world. It's kind of like, you know, reptile and peripheral amphibian world maybe, but people try to justify doing certain things in a tank that is, I mean, again, it can be a big tank. It can be a 4x4 tank or whatever, but it's still not, it's not an 18 by 30 by 10 foot, you know, greenhouse. So a lot of people say, all right, well, I put a terrestrial animal in there and an arboreal animal in there and they're never going to interact. And it's like, well, you've got like three feet of height here. You're telling me that they're never going to interact at all? Like that's like the base of a tree stump. That's nothing. So like, I never bought that argument. Like, oh, they're never going to, yeah, they are. They're going to see each other. They're going to see each other constantly.
Yep. See, and I think there are things you can make work in like smaller, typical sized enclosures, but it's far and few between, you know, like, so there's so many factors, right? There's feeding habits, diurnal versus nocturnal. You have to take every single one of these like factors into account with these two different species and figure out like they are going, like you said, they are going to have some interaction, period. So you have to figure out how that interaction, you know, could be, I guess, healthy, you know, and with most species that just crosses them off the list in a typical size tank. So So there's not very many that I think would work together good. But yeah, obviously, as you can create more space on a massive scale, it kind of changes things.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. You know, something just kind of popped into my head, and it's, well, we're talking about arboreal versus terrestrial, and you mentioned 35 meters up. The first thing that came into my mind was Ufaga. I there was some research that came out. I had a couple of people come on, talked about Ufaga, and some of the research was about males seeking out a certain perch location based on the intensity of the UV lighting from the sun. Obviously not, you know, artificial, but natural lighting. If you got some Ufaga species in there, it'd be really interesting to see how those behaviors pan out, because Ufaga had the potential to become very arboreal. I mean, they've been seen breeding in or depositing eggs in bromeliads 100 feet up and on perches and whatnot. So if you put Ufaga in there, I mean, I don't know if I'd start with like one of the larger obligates, but if you put Pamelio in there, it'd probably be really wild to see what kind of behaviors they exhibit.
Yeah, that actually would be really cool. See that? Yeah, that's kind of got me thinking actually. Because I originally did plan to put some large obligates in there, but I just have since talked myself out of it, just because that's the downside to the greenhouse. So everybody loves the greenhouse, right? But the downside to it is you cannot give spot care to animals. It's really difficult. So the animals that go into it need to be fairly easy to care for, you know? So that's kind of why I talked myself out of large obligates. There's so many issues that could be had, you know? But yeah, Pamelio would be awesome in there. My plan right now is possibly add one more species of dart frog. And I was not thinking Pamelio. I have thought about it quite a bit, but I think I may go with one other species just because I think it would be basically the opposite of the Terribilis.
What did you have in mind? Which, if you don't mind me asking, which species?
No, and I'm not totally decided either.
Okay, so we'll keep it a secret
anybody
then.
Anybody else? No, I'll say it, but I just say you or anybody else listening to this want to give me suggestions or convince me of it or talk me out of it, definitely feel free to shoot me a message on Instagram or something. But I'm thinking of doing Ranitomea variabilis, the Southerns. Just because I know like small frogs in there is kind of like crazy, like, oh, they just get lost. But I already have the Terribilis that are so bold, you can always see them. So I think having some more arboreal frogs or closer to arboreal frogs that are kind of sneakier and you might not see as much could be really cool in there. And I do have a bunch of bromeliads mounted up high. And I'm going to add a bunch more once I'm finished hardscaping. So it'd be really cool to see their like breeding behaviors compared to the Terribilis.
I think it's interesting. I mean, again, it's when you have such a big environment, I guess there really isn't any way to predict the way that an animal behaves in, you know, 18 by 18, whatever, 36 by 36. I can't imagine it's going to be even remotely close to the way that it would behave in an enclosure that size. So yeah, that would definitely be interesting to see.
Yeah, we'll see though. Like I said, I'm not fully decided on it, but that's what I'm leaning towards right now. And I think I'm going to stick to just two species of darts in there for now. My mind may change eventually, but I don't know. Two species seems like the sweet spot for me currently.
No, I agree. I feel like a lot of people go for that Skittles tank, where they want to have one of everything. And it's like, to me, I mean, it's a matter of personal preference. People can do what they want, but like my opinion, if anybody actually cares or like why I take issue with that, is like, I feel like each individual animal is so unique and has such incredible coloration. I feel like it kind of downplays the individual animal by grouping it with other, you know what I mean? It's like they're not Skittles. They're not all the same candy in different colors. There's so many nuances to them. I mean, Terribilis is nothing like a Tinctorius when it's, you know, the subtleties of body size and coloration and behavior. I mean, if you had two female Tinctorius in there, that would be a nightmare. They'd be all over each other. Or maybe not. Maybe they'd seek out territories. I don't know. But
That's worth mentioning too. It's another thing I like took into account when choosing species for, even though it's a huge space, I want fairly communal species, right? So that was another thing about the Terribilis that made them like an awesome first choice. And that's another reason that the Rana Tomeo may be a good choice too, is because they do okay in groups, you know?
You made very good choices. What, you said you had a few other species of frog in there. What else do you have in there?
So I have a couple other species of tree frogs. I got some red-eye tree frogs in there just because I do eventually plan on doing like tours in the greenhouse, letting people come visit and stuff. And you can't, the red-eye tree frog's so iconic, you know, and little kids love those bright red eyes. So when I'm showing them to people, I was like, how could I not do that? Classic frog, you know? And then I also have some blue-webbed gliding frogs, the Rhachophorus reinwardii. Or Reinwardii, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it.
I've only seen them in books. This book that I mentioned all the time on the show that I got in like 1985, this Animal Encyclopedia, it had an illustration of them in there, and I was like, I'm never gonna see this thing in real life. And now people like you have them. That's so amazing. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, and I don't know of anybody that's bred them here in the States. So that's like one of my things I'm really hoping. So I got two females and four males, and I'm really hoping I can get them to breed in there. Cause that's another thing I'm really interested with, like different tree frogs and stuff, to see their breeding behaviors or not. I guess I won't really see their breeding behaviors cause they're nocturnal, but, like their, where they lay eggs, where they prefer to. Cause that's another thing that I plan on doing, hopefully starting it soon, but I'm going to make some little puddles and ponds and miniature streams and stuff in there. So like I said, really diversifying egg deposition sites, including for tree frogs, not just for the dart frogs. And I really want to experiment with where I end up getting eggs from different species. And I'm really hoping I can like learn a lot from that, you know? So I plan on having like one big puddle that's just really black water, super tannin rich, like lightly filtered, slow moving water. And then I'm going to have two other puddles of clear water with a small stream connecting them. And I'm going to design the stream to where some spots are really rocky and the water's moving pretty quickly and it's pretty narrow. And then a couple other spots where it widens out a little bit and the water's a little bit medium flow, you know? So I'm going to create like tannin water, clear water, and then all different varying levels of flow and different sizes of bodies of water. And then I also want to create a couple small puddles that eventually the goal is to create wet and dry seasons within the greenhouse. And I want to make a couple puddles that dry up during dry season and they're only available during wet season. So with all that, I'm like really interested to see where frogs choose to lay tadpoles or lay eggs, I guess. But
yeah, plus all the variables that go into that water within the deposition sites. Like not everybody realizes like how like filthy and gross some of these spots are. I forget. I was talking to somebody like a couple of weeks ago about that on the show about like, you know, birds and dead bugs and all this waste and just terrible stuff that's in these water supplies, and these frogs just seem to just thrive in it. So it'd be interesting to see like a more, I guess, natural approach to just letting them kind of breed free range would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I might get to the point with some of the frogs, especially like the tree frogs, I'll probably, if I find a bunch of eggs, I'll probably collect some and take them home and raise them, right? But I will probably leave some in there. And I might get to the point where maybe if something's like the red-eyed tree frogs will probably do really good in there and breed like crazy, so I'll probably just let them breed naturally. I probably won't interfere at all, you know? But other things like the blue-webbed gliding frogs, I'll probably interfere a little bit, but then let some go natural and just kind of observe them as much as I possibly can. Because you never know, we might learn like some new super weird breeding behavior that might make it easy for other people to breed in captivity, you know? Like I might learn, oh, they actually really like all the spots that have this one thickness of branch 3 feet over it. You know what I mean? Like there might be some weird thing that's just so easy to overlook in captivity that I might just get lucky and stumble upon, and it might help everybody else out with breeding a certain species.
Do you have cameras in there at all? Can you monitor them when it's dark out, or is that something you've considered putting in?
So I have like security cameras in there right now. They're just like ones you'd use for your home, you know, like outdoor security cameras, but they're such bad quality. You can't see anything good, but I do want to eventually upgrade the cameras to like really nice quality cameras. I just need to do more research on them and figure out how that all works. So I'm not, believe it or not, like a huge technology guy. So I really have to do a lot of research to learn how stuff works.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
I guess if you put the camera near maybe a water source, or I don't know if there's like a feeding station, you put like a slice of banana or something like that out on a little tray, and as the bugs go towards it, maybe the frogs will. I don't know. I'm sure there's a way that you could get some good footage, or I don't know, you could record audio maybe of them calling or whatnot. I don't know. I mean, the possibilities are really like endless. I mean, you pretty much do anything.
So the goal too, I'd really like to add a bunch of cool cameras in there, like higher quality cameras, and be able to just live stream the greenhouse 24/7. And people can just go check it out for themselves.
That's a good idea.
I think that would be super cool.
Yeah.
I even thought about putting like a underwater one in the pond, trying to get a nice underwater camera. And then I could do like a automatic feeder that has a limit to like one time a day, so people aren't just feeding my fish like crazy. And if somebody like tips $5 or whatever, they can set off the automatic feeder and watch the fish eat. I think little things like that would be cool. Or like eventually if I have, like, yeah, say I have some frogs breeding or something like that, I could move one of the cameras to like an interesting location and just live stream it 24/7. I think that would be sweet.
That'd be pretty amazing. It's like national parks do stuff like that. They'll have cameras on rooftops looking at falcon nests and things like that. Yeah, that would be really wild to watch, especially the fish underwater. How much of this is automated? If you, like, hear me out. If you, let's just say, Rogan's like, you have to go out of town for a week or 2 weeks or whatever, can you leave this thing alone and it'll kind of function on its own, or do you have to do a lot of supervision?
Yeah, totally. So if I was going to leave for a couple weeks, which I am going to later this year, actually, so I'm like I'm really making sure all the systems are dialed in for that. But the only thing that really needs like interference every other day is the fish need to be fed. Which really, the fish could go a week without eating, probably no problem, but they might start beating each other up pretty bad. They might get aggressive, but the fish eat every other day. But other than that, like outside of the pond and me having somebody come feed the fish is not a big deal. You know, that's pretty easy to do. But yeah, with all the frogs and everything, I could leave it alone for quite a while, and I don't think there would be any issues at all. It's like with the frogs, there's so much for them to eat in there. It's funny, everybody's so worried about them eating in the greenhouse. And admittedly, like I was too, you know, I had my theories, but I was worried that they wouldn't do good at finding their own food, or there wouldn't be enough for them to eat in there. But my biggest problem right now is that all the frogs are obese in the greenhouse. They're all so fat and I can't do anything. Like all the little terribilis are pudgy, you know, which is fine. But like the gliding frogs are huge, and you look at them in the wild, they're not fat frogs. They're like pretty slender tree frogs, and mine aren't. Mine are like obese in there. So I'm actually like somewhat concerned that may cause problems, but hopefully as I get more species in there and there's a little bit more competition, they'll have to work a little bit harder there for their food. I know it's like the first few weeks I put them in there, they were out every night, just calling all night long. This is the blue web gliding frogs I'm talking about. And then after like a month or so, they literally come out for like an hour. And like, I'll go over there at 1 a.m. sometimes and flashlight around, and they'll all still be sleeping. I'm like, you lazy punks, you guys are all in here. Just, you came out for an hour, ate your fill, and you're back to bed.
Yeah. That's why I've never been much of a fan of tree frogs. They just kind of sit there and do nothing for like 20 hours out of the day. But
yeah,
the poison frogs are so active though. Yeah, I mean, that's another thing is feeding, because, I mean, again, feeding in a tank is different than feeding in a big area, especially you're going to have stuff that's going to come in from outside. What kind of microfauna and insects and arthropods, like what's crawling around in that leaf litter that you think that they're eating?
So currently, because I plan on adding as much as I possibly can, that would be a good fit. Like part of the greenhouse is, and part of the experiment with the greenhouse is a hugely varied diet if possible. But currently right now they're eating, that I've introduced, banded crickets, like isopods, springtails, a few different species of springtails, a few different species of isopods, and banana roaches. But things that I did not introduce that just came with the greenhouse there's, I don't even know what half of it is, but there's centipedes, there's all kinds of different little fruit fly like things. Like I have some that I think the terribilis eat a lot, but they're, I should try to get a really good picture one day and try to ID them, but they look like a house fly, but they're tiny. They're about the size of a Hydei fruit fly, slightly bigger, but they look just like a house fly. And I've never seen them bigger than that. So I think that's as big as they get. I have a bunch of those in there and I've seen the terribilis eat them before. So there's like all kinds of little microfauna. Like, so I have the dirt down and then I have mulch over that, like wood mulch. And then I have leaf litter on that. And the wood mulch is kind of starting to break down into its own soil. But if I grab just one handful of that wood mulch and just turn it over and look at it, there is like more species than you could count of just little tiny bugs right there.
And you built a little rotten log biome too that you, it was pretty cool. You did like a little cutout so you could remove it and look inside. How is that aging?
So that's doing pretty good. I've actually, so the original plan was to raise some cool beetle larvae in that. And then I figured out that the beetles I wanted to keep are illegal in the United States. I don't know how I didn't know that sooner. So the beetle larvae idea is gone. I was going to do like some cool staghorn and elephant beetles. But so now it's just kind of a home for microfauna and millipedes and stuff. But I've since kind of turned it into a feeding station. So I feed all the insects, like a really varied diet, because I think that's part of making sure the frogs are healthy, since I'm not like supplementing them constantly like you do in an enclosure, is just feeding what they eat a super healthy diet. So their feeders are super healthy, right? So I feed a bunch of different like rapashi and pangea gel mixes, and then a bunch of like fruits and vegetables and just all kinds of stuff. And I've since turned the little hidden log compartment into kind of a feeding station. So I lift that compartment up and I throw a bunch of their food in there every week when I bring new food over. And it kind of turned into like a spot where all the crickets and roaches and stuff congregate. And I think one of my emerald tree skinks finally just learned that this week, because I found him down there gorging a few times. But yeah, so far it's all working super good. Everything looks good. I got some cool mushroom cultures, some species of some really cool mushrooms I'm going to try to inoculate into the soil around that log, so I can get some cool mushrooms growing on it and stuff. I think that'll be pretty sweet.
That's wild. Yeah, I it's like the, you know, the forest floor is such a cool biome. And when I saw you do that, I was like, oh man, that's awesome. What about supplementation for the frogs? Are you dusting fruit flies, or how are you supplementing?
Yeah.
What you feed them as opposed to what they just eat on their own.
So I do, like I said, there's so much food in there that I really don't ever have to feed them. The only reason I do feed is to help with supplementation. So I feed dusted fruit flies. I say twice a week, but probably half the time I only get to it once a week, just depending on my work schedule and stuff. But I do it twice a week, but half the time, I guess it's like right when the sun's getting ready to go down. So the chances of them actually getting any of the dusted fruit flies are like next to zero. But then every weekend I feed them dusted fruit flies. So that definitely helps with supplementation. But a lot of my hope, and like I said, I'm not a scientist, and there's really no way for me to test this short term or know for sure if it's working, you know? So this is kind of where the experimentation comes in. But I think a super varied diet is hopefully gonna help me with some of that, you know, since I'm not just feeding them a diet of fruit flies. Because even just feeding supplemented fruit flies once a week, you know, that's not really suitable. Oh, one other thing I'm doing too is like the calcium clay. I'm making big clay bath areas. I'm actually doing that this weekend. I'm making big, huge clay bath areas all over the greenhouse so they can go soak and get their minerals and stuff.
Yeah, that's gonna be cool to see.
Yeah, hopefully I can get some cool videos of that too. That might pull out some cool behavior too. See like how the frogs actually do seek out the calcium clay and stuff in like a large area, you know? Like it'll be interesting to see if every time I go check it out, if there's just a bunch of them congregating on it or if they just don't care about it at all.
Mine loved it and they made a huge mess. It was, I had a little, different people do it differently. I kind of made like a paste and I took the lid of a jar and just sort of ground up the pellets, the clay pellets, with some water and just made like a real loose paste. And I'd stick that in there and they went nuts on it. Like the whole, I came back like the next day and looked at it and there was just frog prints all over the glass, and they smeared it on everything. So I don't know if it was, again, I was asking for trouble with the consistency, but yeah, that'll be interesting to see if they hang out there, or if they hang out there at different times of the day. Maybe that would be interesting to see.
See, and I'm trying a couple different types of clay. So I'm trying one that's just like a clay substrate, right? So it's not super soupy. Or, I mean, hopefully that's the theory, at least. I guess I'm doing it this weekend, so we'll see how it goes. But so I'm going to try one that's not super soupy, so I can make kind of a permanent like clay lick type area, or a few of them. And then I'll just add more clay every now and then as it gets spread out or whatever. And then I'm going to have some spots where I put like super soupy clay in. And then I'm even going to have a few petri dishes of like the super wet stuff that, like, I might put one in that hidden log. And then I'll put a couple just like randomly throughout the greenhouse. And I'll probably change those out weekly or biweekly or something. Just because, where I'm not able to perfectly supplement with dusted stuff, I think adding as many other options as possible is really important.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting just to watch them self-supplement, because who knows how much of the calcium in their diet they pick up from mineral sources in the ground. It's just, I mean, you can only follow these things around in the wild for so long before you're not going to see every single thing that they do. But, I mean, you're probably going to get a real bird's eye view of all those behaviors with all these different scenarios set up. Yeah, I'm really curious to see what happens once you introduce the clay. It'd be interesting to, get a follow-up in like a month to see how they make use of it.
Yeah, I'm excited. I've been super anxious for this too, because I ordered it like 2 months ago and it just took forever to send out. So I've been like just anxiously waiting for this, and it finally showed up this week. So I'm like, all right, doing a YouTube video this weekend, putting the clay out there. I'm excited. I think they're going to go crazy for it, especially the Terribilis, but I could be wrong. That's my hypothesis.
You're going to come in the next day and like there'll be like brown smears on everything. Like,
yeah.
The other really remarkable thing about this also is you've got this great space for plants, and the largest tanks that many of us have in the hobby, 200 gallon, 300 gallon, you can get some decently sized plants in there, but you've got a literal greenhouse. How did that determine what your plant choices were, and what's your end goal once the whole thing is planted the way that you want?
So it really obviously just opened up like my options for plants, right? Because I'm also into plants outside of like vivariums too. I'm into like aeroids and house plants and stuff, so this is cool because I got to like combine everything that I like, and I get to take all the like house plants or aeroids that you typically see grown, and I need to get to actually grow them in the proper environment to maturity, which most people never see out of their house plants. So I'm really excited for that. So a lot of the plants are stuff like that that I just want to see grown fully mature, how they live in the wild. But most of it, I just like spend a lot of time looking on iNaturalist and different stuff at just like wild environments and stuff. And I have this idea, which I'm probably totally wrong, but I have this idea of like what the average rainforest looks like. And I'm trying to kind of make, like, originally I plan on just doing South America, but I decided not to limit myself that much, because part of the goal of the greenhouse is to do educational work in there and kind of get people that aren't super into frogs and stuff like us excited about nature and hopefully be willing to help with conservation and stuff. So my goal is to make as many interesting, cool things as I possibly can, but also make it look like an extremely natural rainforest. So I'm really into like little epiphytic plants and stuff. So eventually when I'm finished hardscaping, like every tree branch, everything's just going to be covered in tons of little plants. But obviously I added a lot of the really cool bigger aeroids, lots of the anthuriums that get big, huge leaves and stuff like that. But all the anthurium people are constantly harassing me, telling me I need to add more and more. And I'm like, oh man, these plants, some of their leaves get like 4 feet, even though the greenhouse is a big space, but it's not that big. Like, I got to really think of what the plants are going to look like when they're mature before I add them,
Do you think that keeping plants in smaller vivariums stunts their growth? Do you think that they'll get bigger and more vibrant in a bigger space with more natural conditions?
I think so, but I don't think like keeping them in a vivarium I don't think it necessarily stunts their growth. I think there's just not enough room for them to ever grow to full maturity. You know, like certain species obviously just kind of stay small, you know, and you like pretty much the only things you get to see really get mature in vivariums are like very, very small plants, you know, maybe certain Margravias. Like I have Peperomia emarginella in one of my tanks right now that's gone crazy and kind of gone to flower. So you can see what that looks like mature, but that's like a tiny, tiny miniature plant, you know? So I think like most of our tanks, any medium-sized plants we put in them, by the time they even get close to mature, we have to cut them. They're getting too big, you know?
Yeah, just a good point.
I think seeing them in the greenhouse, they'll see a lot of different stuff, you know? Obviously, like leaves will get huge in there. I think another thing that'll make a difference in the greenhouse too is airflow or air circulation, I should say. Because compared to like a vivarium, I have really good air circulation. And even if I didn't have air circulation, just being such a big space, it's not going to be so cramped, you know? So I think that may make a big difference with plants as well. Because I think that's something that lots of people are starting to realize we've all been pretty bad about for years is circulation. And there may be certain cases where it is extremely beneficial.
You had a unique plant in there that I saw in one of your videos. And for the life of me, I can't remember what it was called. It almost looks like a, I'm at a loss to kind of describe it. Kind of like a half round brown, like disc looking thing. And you mounted it on the side of a cork tree. I'm drawing a blank. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to think. No, you're good. I'm like real close. Is it like a pretty big plant?
It was a pretty decent size. I know you had the big bromeliad that you put on the ground that I saw, and then there was another one. It was looked like some sort of an epiphyte, and I mean the point is doesn't matter what it is, but like you're mounting some pretty decent sized plants. How are they adapting to the cork? You've basically made like pseudo cork trees out of like these big cork rounds. How are they adapting to that being mounted as opposed to say like inside of a tank? Are you getting more vigorous growth? Are they adhering to that substrate more? Or like what's the difference between mounting epiphytes and things like that in this big tank on this huge cork tubes as opposed to a tank is basically what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So I think the difference is I can mount bigger stuff, obviously, you know, so that makes a big difference. But in the wild, most of these plants are either true epiphytes, which means like a seedling falls down, lands on a branch somewhere and grows from scratch, you know, like bromeliads, things like that. And some of the anthurium, some philodendrons are true epiphytes, but most of the plants are hemiepiphytes, where they're like semi-epiphytic. So in the wild, they typically, sometimes they grow fully epiphytic, sometimes they start in the dirt and then climb. And then once they do climb, they could be completely cut off from the dirt and just keep doing good. But so even like Margravias and stuff, that's how a lot of them are in the wild. Like they start down in the dirt on the ground and then they basically go to the closest structure they can and climb straight up it to compete for light. So I think I'm kind of trying to replicate that, but then I'm also adding a lot of the like true epiphytes. So I have like a big philodendron insignia. That's one of the pretty big ones on the cork tree. Then I have a philodendron pulchrum, philodendron spiritus sancti, like some really cool plants that will eventually get huge. And they seem to be doing really good so far. I've learned one thing, like if I buy an already big, gorgeous plant, and then I take it out of a pot and I mount it, which makes total sense, but it kind of struggles for the first month or so. Like it takes it a minute to get adapted to being mounted and not being in soil. So I've kind of learned what I do is I cut back any unnecessary leaves, and then I cut back like 70% of the roots probably. And then I mount it, and then all the new root growth is what attaches it. Because old existing roots won't attach to things. Only new growth will. So you might as well cut back most of the old roots that are probably going to dry out and die anyways. And then I put a little bit of moss around it and attach it like that. But I'm just getting to the point where my big mounted plants are like just getting kind of established and used to it right now and starting to do really good. So we'll see how it goes in the next few months, but I'm really excited to see. My Spiritus sancti, I don't know if you've seen those, but they're a really cool philodendron that grows these big, super long, like sword-shaped leaves. It's like just starting to put out leaves that are the shape of the mature leaves. So I'm just like waiting for them to get bigger. I'm really excited to see how that one goes.
Are you looking to have a really dense, like, jungle vibe once everything is grown in, or are you looking to keep it sparse? How are you, like, what's the, like, the end game here? Like, let's just say that you let this thing grow in for like a year or 2 years or 3 years. How do you want it to look once everything is full grown and established?
Yeah, so that's a great question, but super dense, like grossly dense. You know, that is one thing I'm trying to replicate, a jungle, you know? So I want, when people to come in, especially from Northern Utah, when people walk in, to just be like, oh my gosh. Like, this sounds weird, but I want it to be like borderline claustrophobic. So I plan on, I'm still got a lot of hardscaping to do. So like you saw, I did that one little false cork tree. I'm going to do another massive one that has like huge branches above your head that go all the way across the greenhouse. And I'm going to do a couple big things like that with branches. So eventually there will be like a full canopy of different cork tube branches and different mounted driftwood. And then I plan on completely covering those in epiphytes. Like, the goal is to get it to where when you walk in the greenhouse, you cannot see the backside. Like, you have to look through branches and peek around to see the backside. And then obviously, as far as like the floor, like the forest floor and everything goes, I'll kind of have to keep plants trimmed somewhat to where it doesn't just become an, because if you let things overgrow too much, it also doesn't look natural and good, you know? Like, it looks, if it's just a sea of mushed leaves together, it's not really going to look good. So I'll have to kind of adapt as things grow in. But as far as like right now, I have all the forest floor kind of completed. It just needs to grow in. But I plan on like probably 70% of the plants being at chest level and up. So that, if that kind of gives you a vision of what I'm thinking eventually, it's just going to take me probably a few more years to get to that point.
That's the beauty of it, though, is you get to see the whole thing evolve and grow like it's one big organism.
Yeah. And that's another thing I want to mention real quick. This is kind of off topic, but one of the reasons I want things grown in like that is just for how my vision is of the whole thing, right? But the other thing that's important with cohabbing animals that I didn't mention in the past, I think, is creating visual breaks and visual barriers. So if I have it super densely packed, I'm just creating more and more little micro habitats and more hiding spots for animals. That way there's less negative interactions with animals, or if there is negative interactions, animals can easily get away. You know, if everything's just in a big open space staring at each other all the time, there's going to be problems, like, no doubt.
No, that's the way to do it. That's the way, definitely the way to do it. And you're going to put a bird in there too, right? You have a, it's not a toucan. I can't remember what it's called. It's not a toucan, but it's a similar species, right? You want to tell us about that and like why, how that is going to play out?
Yeah. So I'm still not 100% sure on this, and I'm going to, yeah, we'll see. They're really expensive. There's only a couple breeders I know of in the US, and I'm not, we'll see as the greenhouse matures if I still think it's a suitable environment and it'll work out good. But it is, you're not wrong, it is a toucan. It's just like, they're called Arasaris, which is like a family of toucans, basically. They're small toucans. So you can think of them kind of as little miniature toucans. And the one that I want is a curl-crested Arasari. They're super cool. They're super colorful. Yeah, they're like a little, you know, 14-inch toucan. And they're just cooler than hell. But I want to add, my plan was to do a bunch of birds, like little finches and stuff. But I'm like, that just doesn't interest me that much. And then most medium-sized birds would really like predate all the frogs and stuff like that. But the Arasaris are mostly frugivores. And then they eat, like, they're known in the wild to eat baby birds out of other nests and stuff. But that's not going to be a problem. But the one thing is, they are known to just be like pesky. So they're not like predators, but they will just like play with, or like I could see them killing some little lizards and stuff, you know. But they're also not like super fast, agile predators. So I think with all these different visual barriers, and with the greenhouse having so much room and so many hiding spots, I think I'll be able to get away with having one in there without it messing with the animals too much. But that's why that will be probably the last thing I add once the greenhouse is like fully grown in and super thick with vegetation. definitely if I added it now, I think it would bully all the frogs and stress them out to where they'd never come out of hiding.
One of the things I noticed is that you're not going out of your way to overstock it, which is one of those things that I see people do. Is it's like people will get say, oh, well, you know, I've got this space and I'm going to fill it with all this and all that. And you've been really cautious to not do that. So what do you think the benefit is of having a less is more approach when it comes to stocking it with vertebrates, we'll say?
So definitely, I'm a big proponent of like low stocking, you know, because I really like things to look really natural. And one, like having a massive group of something just doesn't look natural. You don't see that in the wild, you know, which obviously we're not perfectly replicating the wild by any means, but I think it looks more natural to have a few of them kind of spaced out doing their own thing. I think it pulls out better behavior out of animals. Like you see more naturalistic behavior when they have a little bit of space to kind of do their own thing. And a huge thing, especially with like normal size tanks and stuff, I think it's significantly less maintenance. You know, if you have a ton of animals in a space, which this isn't as bad, you know, frog people kind of get away with it because it's not as bad. But like with other reptiles, if you overstock things, you're cleaning up poop daily. Like the tanks stink. They're an absolute mess, you know. If you super understock things, maintenance is easy, super easy. So that's kind of my thing with the greenhouse is I can't afford to be maintaining and taking care of every single animal individually. So I'm better off stocking it low and having it be low maintenance, especially where I'm adding multiple different species. Like I feel like for every species I add, the stocking of the existing species should be lower and lower, you know? It's like, that's what people are shocked to hear, that I only have 6 terribilis in there. They're like surprised. Yeah, I even see them at all. And I'm like, I see all 6 of them in there. They're just out doing their thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, with terribilis, you picked a good choice. You picked a very visible, large, colorful frog that is just an eating machine. No, you stocked it perfectly. How is the YouTube channel?
The YouTube channel's good. It's been a ton of work and very, very slow growth, but it's like just starting to pick up, you know?
We'll take away from it because, I mean, obviously you've created this beautiful environment. You created this incredibly amazing project. What do you want people to take away from it, from watching the channel? Because it's not just showcasing the inhabitants, you also documented the build and everything that went into it step by step. What do you want people to experience when they watch the videos?
So I just want people to enjoy my content. So get out of it whatever you can or whatever works for you, you know. But one thing I want people to realize is that, like, just you can do whatever you want, you know, if you research it properly and look into it. Like if you have some idea and you really want to do it, but you're just super unsure of yourself, just try it, give it a go, do a bunch of research, figure out how to do it properly, but do it, you know, because I really am just like a normal guy. I'm not a scientist. I'm not anything, you know, and I'm not like rich as opposed to a lot of people online seem to think I am, but I'm just like dedicated to making this work. And then the other thing is I want to put everything, all my successes, all my failures and stuff out there to the world. So if somebody else is thinking of doing something similar, I want them to be able to grow off of my mistakes. Like my goal, if somebody built a bigger, better version of my greenhouse, I'd be stoked on it. You know, like this isn't like some exclusive thing that I'm trying to be the only one doing it. I would love for other people to be doing this. And I really want people to start just like rethinking animal care. You know, I'm kind of sick of just the standard being the generic guide. You know, you Google this guide, it tells you they need this temperature, this humidity, this size cage, and that's what you do, period. You know, like that's a good baseline for beginners to learn how to take care of animals properly. And I think we should all start there. But for those that are curious about doing things a little bit different, as long as it's different in the right direction, I really want to promote that type of husbandry, you know. I think stepping outside of the typical bounds of the hobby a little bit isn't such a bad thing. I think we all have a lot to learn from it. And like I said, I want to document all my successes and my failures so other people can see maybe I want to do something and everything's not going to work out at all. And I can be an example of what not to do, you know, whichever way it ends up going. As long as it kind of helps teach other people along the way, that would be great.
And eventually my goal, I won't talk about this too much, but I plan on trying to raise money for conservation with the greenhouse. Like I said, I plan on doing tours and stuff like that. And I'm going to pick certain organizations that I think are doing really good work. I have a couple in mind already. And I want to donate a certain percentage of everything I make to those organizations. And then I also want to use the YouTube channel and stuff to kind of give, because I think there's a lot of people that want to help with conservation nowadays. Like, things are really coming around to where people are realizing that animals and nature are really important. But I think the average person just doesn't know where. Even if they just had money to give away, they wouldn't even know who to give it to, you know? So rather than telling everybody, like, give me all your money, I want to tell people, like, hey, I can eventually get to the point where I can teach people about this certain animal and be like, hey, if you're worried about this animal's natural habitat that's being absolutely decimated, this is a really good organization that's doing something about it. So yeah, a few things with the YouTube channel, but I just want to document the whole process and then kind of help with my future goals as I'm doing it, you know, which is to help with conservation and do something positive towards all the animals that I've had such a great benefit of being able to keep and enjoy.
Is there anything throughout the course of the construction or the stocking that you wish you had done differently? Like, is there anything where you're like, oh, if only I could have gone back and done this way, or I wish I would have changed this, or this isn't working out? What are some examples of things that you learned from and maybe wish you could have or would plan on doing differently if you had a new opportunity to start over?
So this is a hard one, actually. And I know this sounds kind of crazy, but I'm like pretty happy with the way I did everything along the way so far, which I'm normally not like that. Normally, whenever I do projects, I like have regrets and things I would have done way different. But obviously, like, I wish I could just build a bigger greenhouse. I wish the pond could be massive, you know. But given the situation I had, I think I'm pretty happy with how things turned out. The one thing I will say is the pond is heated with a heat pump, like an air source heat pump. And I don't know why I didn't really take this into account. It's kind of a stupid mistake. But the downside to the air source heat pump, it heats and cools the pond, right? But when it's heating, it blows out cold air. So in the wintertime, when it's heating the pond, it's blowing cold air into the greenhouse, which is very annoying and literally makes the heater have to make up for the excess, you know? And then during the summer, when it's hot as hell in there and it's cool in the pond, it's blowing out warm air, like right where I sit. So that's super annoying. So I don't know if, like, I'm not an HVAC guy, but I don't know if like a mini split or something would be better where it's like blowing the air outside of the greenhouse. But I also know there's like efficiency issues with using heat pumps in cold climates. So I don't know how that worked. I'd have to research it more. But yeah, having the heat pump in there, just facing the boardwalk and blasting it with hot or cold air is definitely kind of annoying. So that's the one thing I would look more into and probably do something different. But it works great. So but yeah, as far as there hasn't been any like major fundamental mistakes that I regret so far. I'm sure I may feel different in a few years, but right now I'm like pretty content and happy with how everything's turned out and my decisions along the way.
It came out fantastic. What type of wood did you use for the boardwalk? I forgot to mention that. I mean, if you guys are listening, I'm going to let Zach rattle off some links and I'll put stuff in the show notes for the YouTube channel and whatnot. But I mean, you've got this little wooden path that sort of meanders through it. What did you make that out of?
So I made that out of redwood. Pretty much any wood in the greenhouse I made out of redwood, just because it's the most rot resistant wood and it's gorgeous, you know? So how could I not do that for the boardwalk?
That looks nice. Well, Zach, before we break, I was wondering if you could just maybe rattle off your social media, YouTube channel, just so that all the listeners, anybody who hasn't, go look at Zach's stuff. It's incredible. The video is amazing. It's visually so impressive. So go check it out. I mean, Zach, just kind of tell us, you know, where people can find you online, Instagram, YouTube, wherever. And like, by all means, like, people just go look at the man's channel. It's incredible. You will not be disappointed. That's how good it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for the kind words, by the way, man. I appreciate it a lot. But my, like, I guess my brand, you could call it, is just A Life Exotic. So Instagram is a.life.exotic. Instagram is where I post the most, and I post like kind of daily things on my story. So if you're wanting to like follow really closely and see all the little details, Instagram's a good place. Also, if you want to get a hold of me, Instagram's the best place to do that. I reply to pretty much everybody on there. And that being said, I'm super into suggestions and stuff like that too. I'm like super open about everything. I have nothing to hide with the greenhouse. So if any of you guys have suggestions on anything, definitely feel free to message me. Or if you have questions about anything, feel free to message me. And then YouTube is where I do like in-depth videos, obviously. So all the tutorials, if you want to see exactly how I did a certain thing, go check out the YouTube channel for sure and stay up to date with that. That is just a life exotic. And then I also have a TikTok where I pretty much just share whatever videos I already took for it in the Instagram and stuff. But I honestly don't really care about TikTok, so I probably wouldn't even worry about that. Just check out my Instagram and YouTube.
Yeah, I think TikTok's done for. it's hard to compete with. So.
It was like the first thing that my videos kind of blew up on, you know? So I got all excited. And then I was like, no, I hate TikTok. Even the crowd on there, like the comments I get and stuff, are just like weird. Instagram, I feel like I'm like a part of an engaging community of people that are like, I don't know. I just enjoy Instagram way more. So Instagram's like short form everything I can keep up to date on stuff. YouTube's long form everything. I can put out really cool videos and tutorials. TikTok, I basically just only post on there because I already have videos that I took for Instagram and YouTube. But
I feel like the retention on platforms like TikTok is different because it's just, I mean, think about how quickly people scroll through that and how much time are you spending actually thinking about something other than just getting a visceral reaction to it? So I don't know.
I actually proved that with my analytics too on there, because I figured out when I first created the YouTube channel, less than 1% of people on my I would have a video go blow up on TikTok and less than 1% of people would click on the link in my bio. But the same thing happens on Instagram, and I have like a high percentage translate over to YouTube. So I'm like, TikTok's not even doing me any good. So I was like, whatever. This turned into a podcast that was just bashing TikTok, but you know, whatever.
it's the ultimate short form versus the ultimate long form. There's a reason podcasts aren't on TikTok. You can't consolidate anything into like 7 seconds of content.
And you have to just do all the trendy things on TikTok, you know.
That's just
not really what I do with my content, you know.
I know my kids were laughing at me because I was like I saw a reel on Instagram, and she's like, my oldest, she goes I saw it on TikTok 2 weeks ago, and I was like, oh, that's how it goes now. So I guess it's a generational thing, but Instagram's a weird platform because it went from being so photo-centric with minimal interaction, and now it's more of like they're doing that real stuff, like they're trying to cash in on like the TikTok thing. But I don't think it has like I don't have Facebook, but some of the people that I know who have it, it's packed with ads, and there's all sorts of like crazy Facebook bullshit drama going on there. And it seems like Instagram is like kind of somewhere in the middle where like you can interact just enough, but not like just enough, not to the excess that like Facebook would be, and not like so little that TikTok would be on the other end of the spectrum. So it's for now, it seems to kind of fit perfectly there.
That's a really good way to put it. Yeah. That's like exactly how I feel about Instagram too.
I wish there was another platform though, because I feel bad that some of the people on Instagram who have such really good photographs and really good visuals, they don't get the views and the attention that they really should be getting. Because I'll post a photo, which I think is a good photo. I mean, I've got some decent photos of frogs, and I put them up. I'm like, all right, let's see where this goes. And it's just like, you know, 60, 70 likes, and it's not that much. And then you'll get one thing that will just sort of blow up, and it's like, how did that happen?
Seem pretty random.
It's not like it means anything per se. It's not like it measures the success of anything. It's just, I don't know, I never really figured it out.
Yeah, social media, I think it's one of those things where it's a lot harder than people think, you know? Like, I think like the one video that goes viral is kind of a combination of the last 4 months of work that person's been doing, posting super consistently and using proper hashtags and stuff like that, you know? So I think it's just a lot harder than it seems. But yeah, it does seem there is like a lot of just super underrated people on there, you know. But I think a lot of it is consistency. I think if you post super often, you will just start having things randomly go viral. If you don't post super often, it's like you just don't, your stuff just doesn't go anywhere, it seems like. Like even if I just have an off, like if I'm sick for a week, then I have a bad week at work the next week. If I don't post anything for like 2 weeks, I feel like it affects me for like a month. I don't get hardly any likes, hardly anything.
Yeah. And it goes to your head too. Like I stopped looking at my analytics. Like I'll look at like my downloads and whatnot. Like I used to obsess about days of the week and cause certain, and then I realized like it's, there's patterns, but there's no patterns. And I just kind of do my thing, and I just kind of stopped. I just stopped paying attention to it because, like, for the longest time, it stressed me out. And then I'm like, you know what? Like, that's not really what it's about. So, if an episode does really well, like, I kind of know like which episodes are going to perform well. But sometimes I get like a complete wild card out of nowhere, and I don't get how it happened. Like, I had one episode, I was like, oh, this is going to be terrible, and people went nuts over it. It was like the top episode of like 2023. Yeah. I'm like, why? And I don't know. It just morphed out that way. I don't know.
Yeah, that's how I feel with like little reels and stuff too. I'll spend like an hour editing one, and I'm all stoked about it, showing my girlfriend and stuff, and it sucks. It doesn't get anything. And then I'll post the dumbest video of me on my way home from work, dirty, talking with horrible audio, and it'll go viral. I'm like, what the hell, man? I don't. Every time I think I got something figured out, I don't. But no, I've gotten to that point though where I just realized like I really want all the social media stuff to do good just because it could be beneficial for my end goal. But at the same time, I'm capable of what I'm capable of, you know? Like the YouTube thing used to stress me out. I was like, I need to put out a video every week, you know? And then I'm just like, man, sometimes I'm like working 60 hours a week and the animals and everything are my priority, you know? So sometimes like a video is just not in the cards for me, and I just need to be okay with that, you know? If it's, things are going to happen when they happen, I'm just going to do what I can. But yeah, the whole purpose of the social media is to be able to share it with other people and enjoy it. So if it gets to the point where I'm not doing that, then what's the point?
No, that's a good way of, that's a perfect way of looking at it. So, yeah.
Easier said than done.
I know. I know. I feel the same way. And it's, you reach a point where it's like, well, at what point does it become work and it ceases to be something that you're passionate about? It's weird. Yeah. It's like you go, I mean, look, you're committed to a huge project. So I can't imagine every day you're going to come home and you're going to be like, all right, I'm so enthusiastic to get in there. There's going to come days where you're going to be home and you'll be like, oh man, like I wish I didn't have this. Like, you know, I came home today. I've had a, you know, kind of bad couple of days here with a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, like I came downstairs and thankfully, the animals can function with like a day. You know, I go down there, I look at everybody, I kind of just, you know, give them a salute, and I'm like, all right, I'm going back upstairs. But I know that like a couple of days from now, I know I'm just going to end up spending like 6 hours down there this weekend. But it's hard. It goes in stages. I mean, you know, it's a huge responsibility too. Like, I mean, how much time would you say you spend in there during the course of an average week or an average day?
Man, so I pretty much every day I go there for about an hour at least. And then on the weekends, like most of my weekends, especially where I'm still working on projects there, you know, most of my weekends are spent doing that. Like, I just got to the point where I've ran out of money lately. So I'm like, work slows down in the winter and stuff because I work construction. So, I'm just like waiting on saving up money for more projects. So right now is like the slowest things have been for a while, but we've been working on the greenhouse for like 2.5 years, and me and my girlfriend, she's awesome. She's been helping me with everything. We, for a while there, I was working 60, 70 hours a week. And then probably like sun up to sundown every single bit of time I had off on the greenhouse. And we sustained that for like a solid 2 years with like just a couple little breaks in between. So now things have slowed down a little bit, which is nice. But yeah, I still spend, probably, I don't know, I would say on average, like 20 plus hours a week there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big commitment, but you know what? Like, you find something in life that you're good at and you enjoy, and even though it could be so stressful and so all consuming, you just, like, if it's gone, you couldn't imagine life without it.
Yeah. And the cool thing about the greenhouse is, like we said earlier, you know, if I do need to, if I get burnt out or I'm having a real bad week, it's okay for me to step away from it for days at a time, and it literally affects nothing. Whereas, like, I have a bunch of animals at home too, you know, they need care every other day, period. Like, there's no questions about it, you know, my snakes and stuff like that. I can't just not miss cages because I'm having a bad week. I can't not clean up poop. But the greenhouse, like, I know if I have, like, if I get sick or something, I'm gone for 5 days, I don't even have to stress about it. I know it's all going to be good. So I guess that's one nice aspect of it, is it's kind of more self-sufficient than normal animals would be at home.
Yeah, it makes it a pretty unique environment for them and you, I guess. You know, you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
We all create environments for ourselves, and it's nice to have something that you can really immerse yourself in. I mean, I've got tanks that I enjoy looking at, but I can't go inside of them. I mean, you reinvented the wheel here. You can go inside the tanks, which is just awesome.
Yeah, that was my whole goal originally. I just wanted a viv large enough I could walk inside of it. I just wanted to be able to feel it, you know? That's the other thing. I live in northern Utah, which is basically like a desert. So I've just, my whole life, ever since I was a little kid, I've just dreamed of the jungle, you know? I've been obsessed with the Amazon. And just the longer I live here in Utah, the more and more obsessed with the Amazon I get. So I don't know what clicked in my brain, but I was just like, I'm going to build it, I guess. I'll experience it here at home one way or the other.
Well, you did. You had a perfect execution because it looks great.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, Zach, I want to thank you for coming on. It's been a great discussion, and it's such a unique thing to have a greenhouse and have dart frogs in there and plant it like it's one big walk-in vivarium. So I got to give you a lot of credit, man. You took on a huge project and you executed it perfectly because it looks amazing in there.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. It means a lot to me.
All right, everyone. Again, it was a great, real pleasure talking to Zach. And use of it, go check out Zach's social media, YouTube and Instagram. Just follow this whole process from start to finish if you haven't already done so. It's really amazing. And, you know, again, I hope you guys, I mean, it inspired me. I got some ideas that I kind of drew from Zach's project, and I'm sure you guys will have too. So, yeah, it's been a great episode. Again, I'm real happy with, I've had some great guests on the show this year, 2024, and Zach's been, you know, no exception. So I'm really happy that we got a chance to talk. So, yeah, hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I learned a lot. I'm sure you guys did as well. And I'll catch up with you again next time.